It's good. Did you like that? Do you like that corned beef?
I like the pickles too. Yeah.
All right.
The sauerkraut.
Sauerkraut was good, wasn't it?
Love it.
Hillary McNevin, my
Richard
my,
Cornish.
I'm my co-MC for the weekend. This is our last event. This is the closing event for the festival. It's been three big days, pretty special. Can I say, I was speaking to Libby, before we go, it's that special, okay. And I want you to go home with this idea. We've got a few guests in today. Ian McFall is from San Francisco. He's come here just for this event. He got public transport to Southern Cross. Then he got the train to Geelong. He tried to get an Uber. That was going to be $280. But he found... He went and spoke to a taxi driver. The taxi driver said, that'll be $280. He said, no. He
beat him down
to $180. And he came here yesterday and he's bunking up with a slow food mob. So welcome.
Hello, slow food mob.
Well, the type of calibre is we've got some of the best speakers you can get on the speaking circuit on these matters around Australia. We've also got a chef who's in the world's 50 best chefs in the world.
Hello, Mr. Hunter.
Dan Hunter from Bray. He's a local, but thank you. Thanks for everyone for coming along. Walk away with these messages that you've got. You guys are pretty special. You guys are a pretty special community. You've got a lot to talk about amongst yourselves. Sit down around a beer, around some seafood, around a meal and have your conversations. And that's what it's about. That's what food is about. That's what the CWA Women Bake Scones. It's not to feed people. It's to get them anchored to the seat so they can talk out their problems together. And you guys have got some pretty good stuff to talk about.
Exactly. And conversations, compassion, community. I think all those... This word starting with C, but community and compassion, I think, as well, is what is engendered with people getting together and talking, having a beer, having a cup of tea, eating together. One reason Richard and I think we've both talked about, one of the reasons we love writing about food is just being at the table, writing about the experience and the ceremony and the traditions and the beauty of it. Just having a laugh sometimes too.
Libby Richards, I was speaking to Libby Richards, who works in the Winter Wild Festival program and also works on land care here, said that was the first time, even though she plants trees, does organise fences, organise tree lines, organise shelter belts, stops erosion, stops the soil getting into the waterways, again into the ocean. That was the first time she said that she'd heard fishermen talk about her work and the way that farming affects what they do in the ocean.
The first time. So we need to make that the beginning of a bigger, more consistent and longer forever conversation. We really need to... Now that's open, I think we need to... Can't shut that door again, can we?
Yeah, and she also said, this is one of the few times in the community we actually hear fishers talk about themselves in an open way, addressing the public, because most of the time it's done either at the co-op or in special men's groups called
the pub. But there are women like to go to the pub, and have a beer and a chat. I'm just speaking on behalf of my sisters.
Yes.
So we like that too. So we're happy to be there and have a chat as well.
Mind you, you did a run as soon as that bloke in the pub last night got really rowdy.
There was a rowdy guy in the pub last night and I said, I should go somewhere else. I only had a 7. Yeah. I could get out of there quickly.
Anyone who went to the dinner the other night and saw Frank Camora, that's his Wonderful Guide to Barcelona, and that's on sale over with Liz. If you want to buy that,
it was co-authored with Richard Cornish.
Shut up. And thank you so much.
Thank you, Dan Hunter, for mentioning. You can say that again. Oh, what's this book, Richard?
Brain
Food by Richard Cornish.
Okay, that's for sale as well.
Yes, that's for sale
as well.
You've
got to pay the piper. All right.
Okay, let's
Hillary,
do that.
You go. Your job now. You can do the next wonderful bit.
It's my great honour to actually introduce to you Caleb Gardner. If we can please welcome Caleb. He is Professor Caleb Gardner, I should say. He's a fisheries scientist and the Director of Sustainable Marine Research at the University of Tasmania. Please welcome Caleb. Thank you.
And next to Caleb is a young woman who's doing some amazing research into growing edible seaweed, a PhD student from Deakin University. Please welcome Erin Cumming.
And a teacher, farmer, fisherman, Aboriginal language researcher and author of Dark Emu, Black Seed. It's a great honour to welcome Bruce Pascoe. Thank you. We're going to start with you, Caleb. All right, pressure's on. Not at all. Thank you so much for being here. You, your studies are, and research are extraordinary and very in-depth into the nature of sustainability, managing things sustainably and managing things well. I find that a really... You did mention that in one of our communications about today. But what I want to start with, when we were just having a chat a little bit earlier, you said I mentioned the good stuff, the great... I was very enthusiastic about managing quotas or the management of quotas in the fishing industry. And you brought up a few things that I wasn't aware of. So can you extend the idea of what quotas really mean?
Oh, OK. So we're diving right into the deep end here.
We are. Well, time.
I think the point which we're talking about and I was making was that in a way there's two aspects of quotas. There's the first part, which is just that you limit the total catch. So that's what we call total allowable catch. Yeah. Now, that means that you can't, the commercial fishers can't take out any more than what is set, hopefully set by good science. And that's the element which gives you the sustainability, or hopefully more than sustainability, delivers your, all your sort of main stock outcomes. Right, so that's that part. But there's also, in these quota systems that we have in Australia, another part which we call individual transferable quotas, or catch shares, they're called in other parts of the world. But essentially, you take the fishery and you chop it up into a whole series of shares.
Yeah.
And just in the same way that a company might be split up into shares. And those shares then get allocated to people. And that part of it is, in a way, sort of an economic instrument.
Okay.
It's a way of... And it's that part of it can be quite separate to the way that you limit the catch, and that's got a whole other bunch of sort of social and economic
impacts.
Yeah, yep. Just sort of all mixed up into it. And some of those impacts can be great, and some of them can be not so great, depending on how the whole systems are rolled out.
So
it all gets pretty controversial, actually. Yeah.
Okay. So in a way, we've been talking a lot about the human connection and the community of it. But this is the dry nitty gritty economics of it.
That's right.
I can give you the really
positive example and one really sort of more negative one.
Yes.
If I look back at some of the what I've been involved in over the years, probably some things that I'd be least happy about, or in some ways have been kind of a failure. I was involved in implementing the rock lobster quota system in Tasmania, and we used to go to Flinders Island every year, twice a year, as just part of our port visits, and we'd go and meet people there. And Flinders Island was a bit like this. It was just, there's one town there, just beautiful coastal scenery, a really nice little community. And then when we implemented the quota system, that was supposed to reduce employment in the fishery. It was supposed to make the fishery really efficient, and it did. We reduced the number of vessels down by about 350 boats down to about 200 boats. In fact, now it's shrinking further.
Yep.
But that impact of shrinking wasn't felt evenly around the state. It was, some areas had larger changes than others, and one area that was most impacted turned out to be Flinders Island. And so we would go there sort of year after year, and the numbers of people attending our meetings got less and less, until one year we turned up and there was no one. The whole fishing industry had shrunk completely from that port. And then you started to see other chain reactions in that community that we had, because there were so few fishers there, the boat that was supplying the town became less efficient to operate, and the school became a bit more marginal, and the local government was talking about, do we really need the school? And you could just sort of see all these things happening.
Yes.
And all this was supposed to be driven by having a great economic outcome, but you could just see it really wasn't for that town. So that's the bad side. Now, on the other side, there were people as well who were made very wealthy from this, through this system. And some of them ploughed money back into the community really well. So there was another guy, another port we used to visit, Bishano. Some of the fishers there gained increased wealth, and one of them invested into wineries. Another guy bought up a local aquarium, and so, that was a positive impact for that town. But there were real winners and losers there, and I'm certainly not happy about some of the losers in that whole situation.
Sure.
And I'm seeing the same happening now in some other quota industries I've been involved in, Western Australia, more recently as well. We've implemented a lobster quota fishery there.
And there's an impact again on that. There'll be winners and losers there as well.
That's right, there's winners and losers. And in fact, just to make it sort of more difficult, so often the winners we're seeing through time as well can be people far removed from the community that you think you're trying to help initially. And so I'm involved in an abalone fishery in Tasmania as well, and I see a lot of the just through time, when we held our meetings there, the people who have come along always used to be local people in the community, and their wealth used to sort of feed back in locally. now the people who attend our meetings tend to be more accountants from Sydney, and in fact some of those units are now being sold to companies in China or New Zealand and so on as well. So we're just sort of, you know, we're creating these efficiencies, shedding the jobs from local communities, and it's going, and the benefits seem to be flowing out. So we're still, we've got brilliantly, you know, sustainability, but there's these other levels about what is the benefits.
So is that when you said about managing a fishery sustainably and managing a fishery well, the outcomes you're talking about is about sustainably, and what's the difference then? How do you manage a fishery well?
So sustainability just means that you're not crashing the fishery. And this is just to draw that distinction is something I sort of go on about on it for quite a bit, so people who spend any time around me get sick of hearing this.
But
just to give an example, I was at a conference in Sydney a few months ago, and this was the big one in Australia, the Seafood Directions was called, and we had the federal minister there, and so she was saying how fantastic it is that we have 80% or more of our stocks in Australia are sustainable, and a lot of the industry leaders were making this point as well. But saying a stock's sustainable, what it means is that you haven't crashed it. So it's like, you can imagine if you're the CEO of a big company and you're saying, you know, I have all these stores out there, all these different fisheries, all these different businesses, and over the last year we haven't completely buggered up 80% of them. Isn't that fantastic?
So, okay, yep.
You know, it's really not that great. It should just be your bare minimum that you should accept.
Yes.
And so part of the reason we focus on sustainability, because you have this other, you know, you have so much misinformation of people saying, oh, our stocks are not sustainable, and that's rubbish as well. So most of our stocks are sustainable.
Yep.
They're going to be here in the future. But that's very different from saying those stocks are doing absolutely the best we can. Are they delivering as much money back into the community, or as much food for people to eat, or as much, are we really doing the best that we can? That's a whole different question. And just to give some numbers to that, generally in a lot of our stocks we set a limit of around 20% of its unfished bites, the level where we consider anything below that, this stock is good. There's a lot of love there, but for octopus, for lobster fishes.
Yes.
So we see on our logbooks 50 kilograms landed, but I can be sure that last 1 kilogram of octopus wasn't released gently and lovingly back into the sea. So there are some, so, you know, that system there, I'd say that's a bycatch issue which isn't well managed, and we've got better ways to deal with that, and we should be landing all of that octopus. So and then there's just the last one as well.
Go ahead.
There are some other, there's also what we call, you know, the point was made, there's bycatch and byproduct, right? So bycatch is the stuff we don't want, byproduct is the stuff we're not trying to catch, but we still land it anyway. Now, some species of fish can be one or the other, just depending on how, on whether there's actually a market for it. So we have a fishery in the Great Australian Bight where a large proportion of the catch is this fish called latchet. And they're nice eating fish, but there's actually, so you're nodding, but for most Australians, they're actually not, they're not that premium fish. They're not snapper or King George whiting. They're kind of lower down. And it's actually just not worth marketing, not worth, there's a limited market for latchet, but not a lot. So for the Great Australian Bight trawl fishers, they're returning back to port with space in their boats, but they're still not landing the latchet that they're catching. So that's a wasted bycatch, and it should be byproduct. And the solution to that is getting great people, you know, great chefs, like you're talking about.
To start cooking latchet.
To start selling latchet, yeah. So there's always, you know, there's a lot of product. There's a huge amount of fish in Australia that we're just not really using.
And I think that that's something that I talk about a lot in my work, the diversity. Eating, I've given a lot of talks about seafood over the years and just moderated things like this, and people often will ask just about salmon and tuna all the time.
Yep.
Or a bit of whiting, a bit of snapper and that kind of thing. I think actually, and this is a bit off track for the work you do, but how would you, in a marketing sense, is it just about putting things like latchet and leather jacket and all other sorts of fish just out there? Because we need to diversify the fish we eat. As you say, there's such a great selection out there. So how?
Well.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It's another one. And well, the glorious sardine and things like how would you do it if it was up to you?
I think it's got to be marketing, but also it's just a reality that we have a lot of seafood in Australia that we're probably never going to be able to sell. So in forums like this, we tend to discuss sustainability, but a lot of the fisheries meetings I'm at, just with industry people, they're not worried about sustainability. They're worried about how they can sell their stuff. And we have so many fisheries that are just, it's just a market issue. All the Tasmanian scale fisheries, the catch has just been going down year after year after year, not because we don't have fish, but because we've got this booming Atlantic salmon industry in Tasmania and they just can't compete against it. So how would you solve that? Well, they could start marketing it, perhaps, but that's an uphill battle as well.
Well, it's about people writing articles about different types of fish to eat, you know, things like that.
Yeah.
You know, and educating people. It is about Because the consumer drives the choices that people go and catch and fish and hunt and farm and, you know, I think it's obviously a slow education, but it's something we can get there with.
The scale of it's absolutely massive. So in Australia, we per square kilometre of our coastal shelf area, we land less than 100 kilograms. So that's, you know, 1.5 fish bins of catch, which we land per square kilometre. Indonesia, just on the other side of us, with almost identical ecosystem, in fact, identical ecosystem to northern parts of Australia, lands 10,000 times more catch per square kilometre. So you can just sort of see ecologically, we have a vastly underutilised areas of our coastline, and the reason we're not doing it is because of, well, there's all sorts of reasons, Mark. As a society, we wouldn't want the same level of ecosystem impacts that the Indonesians are willing to tolerate because they need to supply food. So there's a complex issue there, but certainly you can say we're barely touching the seafood which we have in Australia.
Don't we use purse seine netting and they use a lot of dynamite? Is that the case?
That would be fine. No, and yeah, dynamiting was a big deal, yeah.
That was meant to be a joke, but obviously it wasn't.
Timing, delivery. Yeah.
Can I ask a question, Caleb? Okay, there's a lot of seafood eaters in the room. A lot of people aren't going to maybe have time to go out and catch stuff themselves. If we're going to look at stuff that's in the Melbourne markets, what sort of fish should we be eating if we want to be not just eating sustainable fish, but eating fish that are really on their way up, on their way back up?
Well, in terms of Australian fish, you're hard pressed to find anything that's not sustainable. Yeah. It's a matter of, you know, what you like and what you're willing to pay.
Okay.
What seafood do you like to eat?
I like to get good value for money seafood. So that's where there's big opportunities. You can see that's because we do have so much seafood, and people do tend to go for the snapper and the tuna and the obvious
and the whiting,
things.
Yeah.
But yeah, for me, if I go to a co-op, I would be buying the leather jackets and the latchets, not because I'm worried about sustainability, just because they're ridiculously good value.
Great value, delicious fish.
For me, it's.
Yeah.
I'm
sorry.
He's joking.
Sorry.
Again. Okay, so you go for the smaller fish.
Yeah, that's right. Prawns are another example, ridiculously good value. They have wild-caught banana prawns available in supermarkets around for $10, $12 a kilogram. It's just crazy.
I remember having a delicious meal at a bearded gentleman's place of some blood mussels that he'd pulled out of the water down at Mallacoota. They were delicious.
That's Bruce's place.
And completely uncommercial.
Yeah.
Australians won't eat them. My mates won't eat them. So.
But you go to Springvale and they're buying them by the kilogram.
In Victoria, only is dog food because it's illegal to sell them for human consumption. So there's a lot of happy dogs in Springvale.
Okay, thank you very much. No, I think so, yeah. Okay, I'm feeling getting slightly uncomfortable that this is the last session of the festival. I reckon we're going to we're going to be running a little bit over. Is that okay with... Sorry, Liz, we're running a little bit over.
Thumbs up.
We could be running a little bit over just to give you a heads
just
up.
Q&A.
Yeah, Q&A. Look, that was fascinating, Caleb, and we'll probably come back to this more.
We'll talk more.
This is about the future. We're talking about the future of fisheries, and we're talking about the future of aquaculture as well. And anyone who's been overseas will have seen the massive aquaculture, the massive farm that goes on in the estuaries and on the coastlines. And thinking about seaweed production, I was just recently been in Japan and had a look at what they've been doing over there. And that's part of a $7.7 billion business that's global. I think around 15 million tonnes of seafood is produced and harvested around the world. But only in the last couple of years, we're averaging just several hundred tonnes in Australia, and a lot of that ends up as fertiliser or as the as food additives as well. And you know, like things like alginate that end up in thickeners, et cetera, and carrageen for food product. But thankfully, our good chums at Deakin University are doing research into wild algae, but also sustainable aquaculture. And from Deakin University, Erin Cumming is here to talk to us. Erin, thank you.
Thank you.
You've got a little presentation you want to deliver?
Oh, I do. Do you want me to go through it or just start talking?
Yeah, just go through it.
And go through it.
Let us know what you're doing at Deakin.
One second.
So Deakin has a campus at Burwood and at
Warnponds
and at Warrnambool as well.
And Queenscliff is our latest site.
Well,
so that's where I am. So I'm pretty lucky to be down in that part of the world. I can just start talking about basically our untapped natural resource that we have pretty much on our doorstep, and that is seaweed. Australia is home to over 1,000 different species of seaweed. We've got truly unique and diverse marine flora, as I said, right on our doorstep. However, little is known about our seaweed in terms of their life cycles and potential applications. In terms of the ecology of Australian seaweeds, we know that they are extremely important as ecosystem engineers, and that means that they provide a lot of food and habitat supporting other marine animals and invertebrates. Seaweeds have three main groups that some people might be aware of. They're the browns, like your kelp, like the big bull kelp that was out on the beach before. The reds that are a lot finer usually, and the red nori is the one that's wrapped around sushi that most of us are familiar with eating. And the greens, like our sea lettuce, and then we get some other finer greens as well. Overseas, seaweeds have been an integral part of Asian diets for hundreds of years, and we can see just how good the health implications from eating seaweed is over there. So as well as being used as a food source, seaweeds also have other applications that are in many of your household items, such as toothpaste and cosmetics. In Europe, the applications have broadened into using seaweed as a potential biofuel, as well as making seaweed fibres into clothing and into ropes and other twines. And also, they're starting to open up niche markets into using seaweed to distill gin, which they're marketing as alcohol, and in craft beer, which we have some brewing in Coldstream at the moment, so we're yet to try that. So in southern Australia, our seaweed industry is mostly the harvesting of beach cast bull kelp, which is, as you said, being turned into fertiliser. Up north a bit, we have in Townsville, the Pacific Reef prawn farm is using seaweed to bioremediate the effluent that they're producing. So seaweed is really good at uptaking a lot of nitrogen and phosphorus from the environment. So other aquaculture systems like the prawn farming and salmon farming in Tassie, they're thinking about possibly having seaweed farms adjacent to that so that they can try and clean up the effluent that is being produced. Seaweed is also really good at absorbing atmospheric CO2. So in Korea, I think they've just started using seaweed as carbon credits, so the seaweed farm, sorry. So it will take the CO2 through a chemical. Caleb, you might be able to help me with the actual chemical equation for the, into the ocean. And then they use the CO2 for photosynthesis, basically. So the more CO2 they can get in as well and hold in their biomass, it helps them grow, and they love it. So it's also a big win for global warming and trying to mitigate that a little bit. Basically down south, what we're doing at the moment, I'm working with the Victorian Shellfish Hatchery, the Victorian Fisheries Authority, and we've got a partner down in Tassie, Kaiho Tasmanian Sea Vegetables. And we are just in the baby stages of just seeing if it's feasible to bring one of the kelps, Phyllospora cremosa, which is crayweed, bring that into culture and see if we can just start it, spawn it in the lab, seed it onto a twine, and then grow it out at sea. And that's in Port Phillip Bay. So, yeah. Baby stages, but we're getting there.
How's that looking? Have you got anything we can eat yet?
No, not yet. So this is part of mine's a three-year project, and I've got 5 months to go until I hand in my thesis, hopefully. The lab stage is good, but at sea is the tricky issue. Just biofouling is
so
our friend.
We were talking before about Asian Asia being a big producer, Philippines, China, Japan being big producers of kelps and of different seaweeds for mm-hmm. culinary use. What's holding us back? Is it the oceans themselves? Is it the climate? What's holding us back from producing?
From producing, yeah. So the species that are commonly used overseas, we don't have them here. We do have the invasive Undaria, which is wakimi, so that could be harvested and used as a food. But the predominant kelps and other similar species just haven't had that attention or experimental time to see what we can do with them all, and people out there eating them. It's very just in baby scale stuff.
I know it's not your area of expertise, but one of your colleagues, Alicia
Belgrove. Yeah.
Belgrove. She did some organoleptic tests on some of the indigenous seaweeds along the coast here.
So she did a bit of a taste trial comparison. She had a crowdfunded project, and they compared, I think there was five of our species versus the five Japanese species, and we did quite well on the taste trials. We're still doing more of the nutritional side of things, because then that's the whole next step. Everything was also done in a Asian style, so I think most of them were in a miso soup as well. So I think they did all right, but I think we could be a bit more experimental in ways we could use seaweed. We don't have to always have it in that Western style. Try and bring our own kind of swing into it, I think.
Baby stages. Would you mind terribly if we ask Dan Hunter, could you just tell us a little bit about it, about what's going on in the Australian food scene and the use of seaweed? Sorry to pick on you.
I got lazy then.
Thanks. I guess from the just perspective of us in our own kitchen, we actually really don't cook any vegetables ever without the addition of some form of seaweed. In terms of the glutamate qualities or seasoning qualities found in ocean grasses and seaweeds, it doesn't compare to salt, table salt that we use generally, all of us, in any way. The depth of flavour that you can get into simple greens is just amazing with the addition.
How long have you been doing that? When you said you only use that now, has that been through Bray's life?
10 years, probably.
Yeah, more. Great.
So any cooking of any greens, particularly good with green leafy vegetables, like, you know, comparative ground-based vegetables. We always have like broccolis, Chinese broccolis, that type of thing. Adding kelp particularly to the water is just one way of drawing out a really long, long savoury flavour in the vegetable. So yeah, and I mean, in terms of, you know, traditionally a lot of cultures cure fish with salt or the addition of salt and sugar or salt and alcohol, and we don't do that. We wrap them in seaweed. And might leave, talking about, you know, good value fish, we use a lot of mackerels, slimy mackerel, bonito, small bonito.
Love bonito.
Things like that. Things more oily-based fish rather than your classic snappers and things like that.
How long do you leave it in kelp for? Is it the same time as you would?
About 24 hours, so a bit longer.
A bit longer, okay.
And often with the addition of a bit of pressure. So
okay.
In a tray wrapped in kelp with a weight.
Yep.
To help to... basically makes a brine between the glutamate in the seaweed and the moisture that's coming out of the fish.
And it has is the result the same but better because of the flavour, but you still get the same finish and texture you would as from a traditional cure?
I would say it's about 100 times better.
Great.
Awesome. And that's why we do it. I mean, we don't do things just for the sake. We do things because we're quite confident it's a much better way of doing things.
That's wonderful.
And of course, you know, it's just we're always looking from a professional cooking perspective, but also something to do with all of the cooking we do at home and everywhere, all of us, is you want long-lasting flavours when you eat food. You don't just want sharp points. And the way that we get that really savoury nature, is often with plants from the ocean.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan Hunter. Thank you very
much. Thanks, Dan. I was just speaking to Steve Earle, who's from the Bimba. He did want to speak because he spoke yesterday, but he's saying...
Hey, Steve.
But he's saying he's using some wakame out of the harbour and his dishes as well. So I think we're seeing very slowly a real rise of the use of algae seaweed in cooking, just because it tastes so bloody good.
So good. Do you use yours as a seasoning agent too, Steve? Yeah. You do? Okay.
I think we're still on for that 6:30 booking too. I'd say four packs, okay? Yeah. So I'm not going to go to six. I'm not going to go to Apollo Bay without dining at the Bimba. All right.
It's true.
All right.
Don't do it.
Erin, thank you. Thanks for telling us about that. Before you go, you're only got a few months away before you finish your PhD, is that right?
Hopefully.
Well, you're going to pass. You're a Traralgon girl. Look at you. You can do really well, of course.
If you don't, no pressure.
They're coming, they've never failed.
Yeah,
so,
they love it.
Yeah, I'm doing it for mum and dad, don't worry. But look, what's going to be your future? Is your future going to be, do you think, or people like you, will it be within 5 years a... some algae-led recovery in some coastal rural towns?
Oh, I would love that. Hopefully, if we can secure more funding and get industry involved a lot more to keep boosting it up, because it's still, compared to what's happening over in Europe, like Northern Europe, Scandinavia, they are just so far ahead in their algae culture. It's crazy. So if we can bring that knowledge here and ramp it up, that'd be, awesome. And I'd love to be a part of it, obviously.
Yeah. Aaron, thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron.
All right. We're going to change tack a little bit now. We've been talking about the sea. We're going back to the land. We're going back to the land and the sea's relationship. And to do that, we've brought out the big guns. No offence to anyone else in the room here, but this man is a consummate storyteller. And when he speaks, I think everyone shuts up and listens. He's an author. He's been a local boy. And now he's leading the way, telling some amazing stories about pre-European Australia, what it looked like, what it smelt like, and more importantly, what it tasted like in his book, Dark Emu. Will you please welcome to talk about The Past is the Future, Bruce Pascoe.
Well, one of the things we never talk about when we talk about sustainability is population. No government in the world will ever voluntarily talk about overpopulation of the earth, and we need to. All of our pollution is driven by overpopulation. Threats to food production, food availability, is partly driven by capitalism and the disproportionate sharing of the food of the world, but it's also driven by numbers, and eventually we're going to have to address that, and some poor politician will have to be the first person to do it, or maybe the public themselves do it. But if a politician does it, they'll be shot within a week, and the second one and the third one and the fourth one. The sort of people who will have to sacrifice themselves for the truth that we are attempting to kill the world. And, if we don't want to do it, then we have to really look seriously at the way we use resources. And, it's heartening to hear the stories of sustainability of Australian fisheries, but it's not the same elsewhere. And the Australian soils, for instance, we've lost 3 metres of soil in Australia generally. It's a hell of a lot of soil. It's all topsoil. So if that's good environmental practice, then I think it's been designed by John Howard. The test for that is driven by someone who doesn't care about the world. So we have to think about that. But on a happier note, Richmond won the grand final. I always find an opportunity to mention that.
Yeah, it,
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm a Yuin Bunurong and Tasmanian man, and I have been ignorant about my culture, and over the last 40 years I've been learning more and more, not just about family but about the environmental practice. And in being pulled up by Aboriginal people from this district, actually, a bit further west than here, Uncle Banjo, Clark, and some others, many of whom are dead now, I was forced to relearn the entire history of my country, because I believe what I'd been taught in school. None of my school teachers was a monster. They, in fact, showed inclinations to want the best for me and their other students, but they were teaching me a history that they'd been taught. And one of the amazing things about our history is how parochial it is and how selective it is. You think you're getting an education which has been refined by the best minds in the world for the coming minds of the world, but I discovered that that's not the case, because in my history I learnt that Aboriginal people were hunters and gatherers, didn't have, you know, in some cases my history told me that Aboriginal people didn't know how to make fire, didn't know how babies were made. It didn't stop them from trying. But, you know, all this perceived ignorance was a deliberate ploy of colonialism to indicate that Aboriginal people, Indigenous people anywhere in the world, you can follow it through the Americas, Africa, Asia, the Indigenous peoples of the world were denigrated by Europeans in order to justify the taking of the land. And there, you know, I can say that lightly, but I can also back it up by things like the Papal Decree, Papal Bull of 1493, Alexander VI, which talks about explaining away the removal of the land and the lives of North American Indians so that Columbus's discovery of America could be justified. I mean, there's a direct link between that bull and what happened next, and it's just lockstep from there on in. So a lot of these things are tied together, and I wrote a book called Convincing Ground, which I wrote about the war between black and white in Australia for the land. But in doing that, I also found out about some incredible features in Australia: massive dams, massive fields of agriculture, massive fisheries. And one of those fisheries being the oldest human construction on Earth. And, I'm reading a sentence like the oldest human construction on Earth. I read Sir Thomas Mitchell talking about riding through 9 miles of stooked grain. These are European terms. These are European terms describing agriculture, and yet our entire education system, our entire political, economic and social system never references these facts. Why? Because it's an arm of colonialism. It's part of the colonial rules, how to take over a country and then pretend that you're Pollyanna. Everything's sweet. Aboriginal people should be grateful that Europeans arrived. That kind of story. Still being told. And the debate on January 26th is part of that indication of a country still struggling with its identity, still struggling with its history. How am I going, Richard? Have I completely deviated from the script? Or I'll interrupt you here now anyway. I discovered these things. And I'll get to the point we were talking about on the beach there, and what a luxury it is to go from a conference room and sit on the beach and watch the sea. This is a fabulous town, always has been. And I was just thinking before down there, in wintertime here in 82, 83, around that time, you could fire a cannon down that road in May or June and not hit anyone. Unless you were pointing it at someone, of course. There are a few of them. But, you know, it was a really quiet town, and now there are enormous numbers of people coming here to enjoy this incredible road. But the funny thing about development of a country and its economy is you sometimes lose the history. So about 8 days ago, I had this fabulous experience. You know, one of the great experiences in Australia, I think, because Judy Watson, an Aboriginal Murray artist, emailed me about 3 years ago and said she'd read Dark Emu, read about the grains, read what Mitchell saw of Aboriginal people having 9 miles of stooked grain in preparation for flour making. And it alerted her, so she rocks up to Yarrabah to do an artist workshop there and sees there a loaf of Aboriginal bread, which was ancient. It had been taken out of an oven. And think about that. Who bakes a loaf of bread and never comes back to eat it? Usually the dead. So this loaf of bread is removed from the oven and housed at Yarrabah Museum. And I get told about it by Judy Watson, and I follow it through and I ring up the museum, only to be told that when Tony Abbott removed all the money from Aboriginal organisations, as a move to improve the Australian economy, of course, when he did that, all Aboriginal museums, which had been funded by Department of Aboriginal Affairs, etc., they had to disperse their collections. And the loaf of bread that I was hunting down got dispersed or lost. And I searched for it for 2 or 3 years, and it became more and more depressing all the time. I thought there was only one of these things. Then I got news that there was one in Melbourne Museum. I got terribly excited. There was a catalogue entry for it called Aboriginal Bread, and went down to find it. And the person in charge of the museum said, well, the good news is there's a catalogue number and a box. The bad news is the box is empty and they couldn't find it. So I'm thinking, here's this thing that I can test to find out about the grain used, the cooking method and the rising agent. All of those things are going to be incredibly important for Australian cuisine, and the museum has lost it again. A different one. I get another one, Aboriginal bread. So I chase that one down, and it turns out to be the fungus. There's a underground fungus, which is also called Aboriginal bread because Aboriginal people ate it. And I'm just about, you know, it's really starting to affect me. You know, I'm a Richmond barracker. I plummet into despair easily. It's an old habit. Anyway, young Aboriginal woman, Kimberly Moulton, is working at the museum independently of anyone else in the museum or, in fact, on Earth. She starts doing a search in the catalogue and she finds all these aberrant entries. They're not called damper, they're not called bread, they're not called flour, anything. She's got no connection, but she starts finding things that she thinks are peculiar. This is a detective at work. She follows them up and goes to have a look, and there they are. They're breads. So I go along there and look in that room, and she's displayed about 17 or 18 of these breads. And the first one I come to is a box of 5 breads. The box is 1.5 metres long, and each of these breads is that round, it's that deep, and dark, dark grey, brown to black. And it looks like a little rye cob. You could stick it in the bakery over the road and people would walk along and say, yeah, I'll have a sourdough, I'll have a breadstick, and I'll have a cob loaf, thanks. That's what it looks like. It's bread. Not damper, not, you know, seed cake, it's bread. Let's just call it bread. And the reason we don't call it bread is in order to underrate Aboriginal culture and ingenuity. We know that Aboriginal people baked bread 65,000 years ago, and we know that that is 48,000 years before anyone else thought of it. So that woman who invented bread, we think probably in Arnhem Land 65,000 years ago, was a chemist, because she's taken a strange object, the seed, ground it into flour, looked at it and thought, gee, I need chemistry to back me here. So she's added water, and now I need physics to help me here. So she's put it in the hot coals, and she's made bread. An incredible moment in world history, and none of your children will ever have heard of that fact. This is an amazing thing which goes completely unknown in Australian history, and it shouldn't. This is something we should be proud of. We should go to France and walk into a bakery there and say, oh, my people invented that. And it'll be terribly popular with the French. You can imagine. They're going to love you for that information. So all this is waiting for Australia. And those dark breads were made out of water lily seed. You know, if you can't sell water lily seed bread, I'll go here. Because you can imagine, you know, Aboriginal people wading into the lagoon collecting water lilies. It looks like a good brand, doesn't it? I mean, you can flog that. That means there's a hell of a lot of water lilies going to go missing. But that's the thing. It's got to be, you know, how sustainable is that industry? You might increase the number of ponds at the right depth and temperature for water lilies, but you're still faced with the problem of conserving the earth. The other ones were made out of nardoo. Now, nardoo is a clover-like plant that springs up in shallow lakes in Australia's dry interior. When the water disappears, the nardoo drops to the bottom of the lake bed, sheds its seed, and you can sweep it up with a brush and pan. It's voluminous. It occurs naturally, and Aboriginal people were converting that into flour. And for the first time in my life at Melbourne Museum, I saw a nardoo bread. And once again, it was, you know, the human hand, when it's shaping dough, ends up with a round or oval shape. And so these human hands have made a bread like that. Some of them were oval, some of them were round. And on some of the grinding dishes where the nardoo and the wattle seed were being ground, you could see that some of them were ground by left-handed women, some by right-handed women. It is so intimate. And that's the story we've got to tell our kids and ourselves in Australia, that this wasn't done by ancient people, it was done by living Australians, and still is to a certain extent. And we are experimenting with that now and doing it out of different grains. But the thing about the nardoo in particular, this country wants to grow nardoo. You don't have to prepare the soil. You don't have to water the soil. You don't have to drill seed. It'll grow nardoo. Just leave the country alone. It wants to grow there. Aboriginal people recognise this is a plant that wants to grow, tested it, found it flavoursome, found a recipe for it, and the rest ought to be history, except it's not. We ought to know these things because they are truly sustainable. Our country wants to grow them. We don't have to bludgeon the country with pesticides, herbicides, fertilisers, or inundate it with water. It is ready to grow in this country. And when I saw the water lily seed, I was thrilled because I thought, I'd never even thought of that. So there's another asset the country has. And the nardoo and the panicum and the kangaroo grass, all of these things, they really want to grow here. And there'll be, in Australia, there'll be district breads. The people that have got panicum, the people that have got wild walia, the people that have got water lily, the people that have got nardoo, they'll all be making their district bread, and it'll be a sensation. It'll be a tourism thing. If only the country can wake up to itself. And I've been saying for a long time that in all, this is soft history. You can eat your history by eating these foods, but you can't eat our food if you can't swallow our history. The two things go together.
Bruce, sorry, I'm still digesting that.
Yeah. I thought of that myself. You're on the two stubbies of bogues, and it just popped out.
It happens. Yeah, you're talking about the conversation we're having about hard-hooved animals pugging up the waterways and stuffing up the native grasses, etc. You had a response to that?
Yeah, all the early records of Australian soils were that they were very light, very fertile, very moist, but very light. And that in around Melbourne, you could run your fingers through the soil. And the same could be said for country around Benalla, that the soil was so fertile as a result of the production of Murnong, something we haven't even talked about yet, that you could run your fingers through the soil. The hard-hoofed animals, according to E.M. Kerr's own diary, he's the bloke who brought the first sheep into that district, those sharp-hoofed animals compacted that soil into a pan within 18 months, and that country experienced its first floods. Aboriginal people were astounded when they saw water running off their soil because they'd never seen it before, because the soil was so friable, the water was going straight in. And as a farmer would know, that is an incredible advantage. So the hard-hoofed animals have done an enormous amount of damage, and it's like overpopulation of the world. No one wants to talk about hard-hoofed animals. More and more Australians are becoming vegetarian. That'll have an impact on them. But if we are going to eat protein, we should be eating kangaroo. I drove 900 kilometres last night from Tathra to Apollo Bay. I reckon I probably passed 1,000 carcasses. It got ranging from wombat, wallaby, kangaroo, echidna, all sorts of things, possum everywhere, ringtail, brushtail. All of these things are edible. And in a world which claims that it's there's not enough protein to go around. There's plenty to go around in Australia, but there apparently is not enough to go around in Africa and places like that. Surely mathematically we can do something about that, because that's all it is. It's a mathematical thing. But with a simple probe to test the body temperature of the carcass, and if you did this at dawn, I reckon about 30% of those carcasses can be converted straight away into meat. That's if we wanted to do it. If we wanted to not waste protein, then that is something that we could do. All of these things are doable. We just have to want to do it. And I think, harvesting kangaroo, if you don't... Look, selling roadkill is going to be hard. but it is not as hard... It's nowhere near as hard as telling Melburnians with the best quality water in the world that from now on they should start drinking water out of a plastic bottle. The person who did that is a millionaire, obviously, but is also a shrink, because they shrank our brain. Because we had good water in Melbourne. We still have terrific water. But I remember about 20, 30 years ago that there was a whole lot of stuff in the press about Sydney and Melbourne water, talking about the waterborne bacterias and things that were going to kill us. And within a year, we were drinking water out of a plastic bottle because it was seen to be healthier. It's not healthy for the planet, but it's healthier for the Australian budget, and it's driven by Coca-Cola Amatil. And usually you have to make sure there's no one at the back of the room with a gun because it's an American company. And, you know, these are the things we do have to address. Sorry, Richard. He was going so well and I've ruined his Sunday.
You talked about Thomas Mitchell coming through on his his big trip down south. He went through an 8,000-year-old structure. Can you just touch upon that? Can you tell that story? Out at Lake Honda?
The system out there is incredibly intricate. You can do a tour of it now through Budjibim, a local Aboriginal organisation. And it's one of those pieces of engineering that Aboriginal people managed over a very long period of time. But because it was volcanic, it's probably only 12,000 years old compared to Brawarrina, which is much older. Some of those channels were chipped through the basalt.
Yeah. We have to establish that it was not just an eel place where the eels were caught, but were farmed, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not just an opportunistic catch.
Yeah.
It's a deliberate attempt to regulate the movement of eels and to sequester some of those eels into ponds so you can use them for later and manage the whole system over thousands of kilometres. And we don't know how vast that is yet. You know, I notice that people are now saying thousands of square kilometres, but in fact it could be more than that, and it could be repeated elsewhere. You know, the exciting thing, Richard, I know I upset you before talking politics, perhaps we should talk more politics in this country and less rubbish. When we talk about these things, we need to get back to the very essence of human development, because this is really old culture here, 100,000 years, 125,000 years easily. And an archaeologist mate of mine has been working at a town in western New South Wales, and he has uncovered the oldest village on Earth. Now, this village is demonstrably the oldest on Earth, which means that Aboriginal people in Australia invented society. If this is a village and people have voluntarily collected together for the first time, or at least the oldest time, and we're presuming the oldest time is the first time, then that's the invention of society.
Predating Australia. Predating the Turkish sites.
Yeah, well, the Turkish sites are something like 40,000 years old.
40,000, yeah.
And these are much more ancient than those. And this is what we have to do in our country. We have to embrace the fact that this society is not only old, it's incredibly successful and incredibly innovative. And I've got some photographs on a PowerPoint that I can't use today. One is a stone tool, which was only discovered 2 years ago. Its use was only discovered at... That tool had been in the Australian Museum for 150 years, along with about another 1,000 companions. No Australian knows about it. It's a pick head, an Australian Aboriginal pick head. There are all sorts of knowledges which we are suppressing in this country.
What was it used for, Bruce?
It was used to turn the soil. It was used to weed Murnong patches. My son Jack has got one of the biggest patches of Murnong. Well, 3 years ago, I reckon it was probably the biggest patch in the country at the time.
Can I just ask your permission? Do you want to hear the Murnong story from Bruce? It's one of Victoria's most important stories. Bruce, can you tell us the Murnong story, please?
Yeah, I'm sorry for hogging the thing, but I see these as vital stories for Australians to learn. And the sad thing is that this is always a surprise to Australians to learn this. But Sir Thomas Mitchell, before he got to Lake Conda, In what I learned at school was Australia Felix, these vast green plains of central Victoria that stretched from more or less Williamstown right through to Adelaide. And this was some of Australia's most fertile soil, and it was empty of trees. Read Bill Gammage's book, The Biggest Estate on Earth. Bill's got a great thesis on this. But this incredibly rich soil virtually had no big trees in it because Aboriginal people were farming it for Murnong, and it stretched to the horizon. Now, there's only one book you can read at the moment on Murnong. It was written by Beth Gott from Monash University, and without her we would have nothing in print about Murnong. And yet this was the staple food of Aboriginal people. They were seen harvesting this and just turning it up in the bushel load. You know, in the old documents they were referring to bushels of this thing. It's an incredible little plant.
What is it, Bruce?
It's Microceris lanceolata or Microceris scapigera. Jack's got a plot in behind the school here, actually, which is, you know, one of the most successful in the country because Jack really should be talking about this, and Shelley and Clark, their dog, because Clark's always asleep there. But those plants over the years, Jack and Shell cut it out of Kaikuyu. So the Kaikuyu kept on coming back up through the plants. But after a while, all the plants overlapped each other and suppressed the Kaikuyu. It's an incredible product, Australian product, an Australian food. And cooked in butter, it converts its fructans into the sweetest liquor that you've ever tasted. It's a beautiful vegetable. Australians will be eating it. We know nothing about it. And the reason I mentioned Beth Gott was because here was a woman who defied her own university to write that book. Because everyone else, you know, they're all men. She's 97 years old. Imagine, you know, when she started this work in the 60s and 70s, she was a young woman then, and she was the only woman, and she was having to argue her case against her male colleagues that this was interesting, this Aboriginal information is interesting, and they tried to talk her out of it.
Bruce, would you mind if we pass the microphone around and ask questions, and also Aaron and Caleb as well, if you've got questions. Please put up your hand if you let us know what your name is and where you're from. And I will start asking questions. Then we can then finish up, and then the bar opens with pouring some sparkling wine, if that's all right with you, with your kind permission.
Yeah, Tim Godfrey from Maringo. Good to see you, Bruce. Still bowling us over with facts and research. I've actually got a question for you. You mentioned in your book the Gabardun women were instrumental in harvesting abalone along the coast here, and on a seasonal basis, if I'm correct. But the evidence for that is along live remains along the coast is not there, or because they degrade rather quickly. I was just wondering if there's any other, you know, what the intensity of the research into these deposits along our coastline, what can they tell us about our Great Ocean Road coastline and the intertidal marine life?
Well, the middens today tell us about the really hard shell foods that Aboriginal people ate, like turbo shell, things like that. But the softer shell things like abalone, crayfish, they can only be discovered when you microscopically analyse the material, and that hasn't been done very often. But we can prove that Aboriginal women were involved in that because they were seen to be involved in it. Europeans saw Aboriginal women collecting it. And in the Melbourne Museum, there are the bone structure out of the ears of Aboriginal women has been investigated from that era, and most of them have what is now called surfer's ear, exposure to really cold water on this coast for diving for abalone and all in, you know, in the winter. And the bone growth is built up there to protect the ear. So some scientists are analysing that and making all kinds of evidence-based assumptions on how that catch worked. So that sort of work is being undertaken in 2017, 2018, 130 years after European occupation. So there's a lot to be learnt. But we don't know exactly how many fishes, how many shells Aboriginal people were targeting. All we can tell is what is evident there. But I was on the Toowoomba River, Tim, in South Gippsland a few days ago, and there were oyster shells in the midden there. And once again, the oyster shell very hard, it'll last for a long time, and that's why it was so evident. But they were that big. These are massive shells. It's not the same as the Pacific rock or oyster or Sydney rock oyster, any of those. It's an oyster that big. It would have had a piece of meat in it that big. You know, this is a very important fishery. And basically that that fishery is disappearing in those rivers because of pollution coming down from forest operations. So we're selling good Australian trees to Japan to convert into wood chips so we can bring it back here as paper so we can wrap hamburgers. And we're killing this beautiful shellfish.
Can I just jump in there as well? So just yes. So one of the things you're talking about there, Bruce, is just the way that you, you know, you have this information about the size of animals in the past. So oyster, that particular flat oyster fishery, that's been pretty much wiped out across most of southern Australia, certainly around Tasmania as well. They're one of the few species that could be harvested from the sea and kept without refrigeration. So they're very popular in that fact you could transport them to Melbourne from Tasmania and from elsewhere. So they did tend to get a hammering, and we've got very low levels of those oyster reefs today. But it is interesting going back to middens as a way of trying to get a sense of what some of the size structures of our seafood was like. Oysters are particularly well preserved, but there's a few other things. We're interested in the moment, we're starting to look into the collections, and there's a reasonable collection of lobster mandibles, so just the very hard jaw parts at the front of the lobsters, which they use for grinding the food. Almost all the rest of the lobster is gets lost in the middens, but often you'll find those little mandibles have been retained, and so they are in collections. And so we're trying to then rescale the size of those mandibles back to see what the lobsters were, and just getting a sense of what the size of lobster populations were around in, you know, much longer back in what our data is at the moment, and that gives us a way of trying to get a sense where the growth has changed through time. You imagine climate is affecting growth, so there's some good information in these middens for
perhaps a suite of fisheries.
Well, we're still in the process of doing that, yeah.
I just want to move like the giant lobsters, like huge ones.
It's interesting, some of the really old records, Flinders Island I talked about before in the context of that change that's happened in that community, some of the old fishing records is that used to be a place now that where they used to have quite small animals. And today that'll be a place where we find some of the biggest ones. So that's in a fairly short period of time. So certainly seems like the growth of these things change. There's some trapezo tractors up there now.
Can I just throw into that oyster story, Bruce? There's a mate of mine who's here at the festival this weekend. Her neighbour up near Dalesford, she's an old lady. Her family had been there for years. There was a gold rush house on the place. And they found a midden, an oyster midden in Dalesford at the back of the place. And that's where all the Angazi oysters were sent from Melbourne, from the Melbourne fishery in 1850. And along with this oyster midden, there are a whole lot of Veuve Clicquot bottles. Veuve Clicquot bottles. And apparently the story is they were served on ice that was imported as ballast from Boston. So as soon as we hit here, 1835, 1850, we were partying up, having one of the biggest party, eating all the oysters out of the bay, washed down with French champagne on American ice. You know,
fantastic.
We don't really like it. We don't really eat locally. It takes us a while. All right, we need to wrap up now because we need to open the bar. And basically, it's a bit... And I've just been given... Oh, hang on, it's just news flash.
I could talk too, but yeah.
You didn't tell us about the craze.
Co-op has a bit of excess cray happening. And a special just for you today.
Yes.
No, almost $30 for half a cray, cooked cray. Available now. To what time? Do we have a time, Liz? Or that?
Till we run out.
Be mad if you're not. Get yourselves down. Do yourself a favour. Everything you can think of. So they can go, they're there all afternoon. Someone will be there to take your money. $30, half a cook cray. Bargain.
All right. That's almost finished. But before we've got a little bit more to do, but before we finish up here, can you please thank Caleb Gardner, Erin Cumming and Bruce Pascoe. Thank you so much for talking today. This has been Conversations on the Edge. This is the final event of the 2018 Apollo Bay Seafood Festival. And now, to officially close this amazing festival, will you please welcome Festival Director Beck Malherbe.
Woohoo!
Thanks, Hilary. Thanks, Richard.
Oh, pleasure.
Thank you to all the speakers. I didn't get a couple of bogues on the way, so I'm probably not going to be as articulate as some of the people that can just talk on the fly here, but I really just wanted to say thank you to all of you who took a little bit of a punt and bought a ticket on today's event, and to any of the events that are in the festival. We've, as a committee, we've taken a little bit of a sidestep with the festival. It's in its seventh year, but for those of you who don't know, it's been run by a committee of 100% programming volunteers. So there's a lot of hard work and sweat that has gone into programming the events over the weekend. But really, the audience that's here today are the ones that I really want to thank, in addition to our wonderful speakers as well, for really coming down to Apollo Bay. And thank you to those who are local as well for coming to town. And I hope you've all had a chance to check out the weekend of events. And there's a few little drinks in the room. So thank you to all of you. Thank you to the wonderful committee and all their work, particularly Liz on today and Marcus. Thank you. Thanks. That's all I have to say.
It's time to go to the bar. Please, till 3:30. It's just time to have a drink. Thank you all for having Richard and I too.